You know, you might think that having to fight a war is pretty hard, a war that's almost reached its four-year mark, even harder. But it turns out that it can be even more complicated if you're full of corruption. And Volodymyr Zelensky has long been accused of that. There's all been rumors for a long time that he's been siphoning off money. He's been buying properties in all these different places. It's really been hard to determine how much of this is just his opponents attacking him, how much is just claims. And, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Well, now then we have some pretty hard evidence that somebody very close to Volodymyr Zelensky has actually been engaging in some of this. And now then it's been exposed and it's causing potential huge problems for Zelensky at home and abroad. And we're going to take a look at what this means for the war effort. And we have with us today, Larry Johnson. Larry, this is Jared Johnson. He's got a different kind of shirt on today, but at least different, you have something really shirt. Bright in here. So I'm really glad about that. I'd have been worried if you just had a normal shirt on for the show today. So first of all, welcome to the show and explain to people why you're not in your normal digs.
I'm a traveling man. You know, to sing Rick Nelson's song, traveling around the world. So I'm heading overseas and had to put on some normal clothes. Plus, I'm in a more wintry climate.
You are. As a matter of fact, you're not far from where we're broadcasting right now. And just to let folks know, you and I had dinner last night. It was one of those few times when we actually can get together and we really enjoyed it, having some good Korean food there. So we really enjoyed that and had a great time together. Always value that.
Absolutely. Amen, man. That was great. Yeah. Love the honey pig.
Yeah, that's it. Not a honey trap, though. I just want to be clear on
this. Yeah, that's right.
That's different.
Honey pig, not honey trap. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that was really good, though. But what's not really good for Brother Zelensky, and I guess it's really just that he's finally been caught here, and the question is going to be what's going to happen next. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what this is, because this is apparently one of his right-hand men and, has been really up there at front about getting money that's coming in from the West, from the United States, to make sure it gets used in warfighting ways. But as we find out, maybe it's not quite like that.
Well, I am sort of puzzled by the story because it strikes me as a bit of diversion that they're making a big deal about $100 million. Now, $100 million is a lot of money, but I'll call him my former business partner. We've closed the consulting business we had, but he's still out doing things. He filed a whistleblower complaint with the Department of Justice and the Pentagon regarding $48 billion. Let me emphasize billion, not $100 million, $48 billion that was pilfered by Volodymyr Zelensky and his crew. And as a result of that, the Department of War, Department of Defense, whatever you want to call it, their criminal division, they've opened up a criminal investigation. So that investigation is well advanced. So, and, you know, part of that money was, it was kicked back to U.S. senators and members of Congress. Now whether those members of Congress will actually be held accountable, I'm not holding my breath on that, given the corruption that's endemic in Washington. But this may be an attempt, you know, Zelensky could be leaking this out just to divert attention away from himself. Yeah, here are the bad guys over here. Ignore what I'm doing. That kind of thing.
And I'm sorry, I'm looking because I'm getting some information here from Kiev and some folks that have been talking about this for a long time. And one of the things they're telling me is that this is, you know, kind of like you mentioned, this is something that's been going on for a long time. And they're trying to get it out in the open, to get it taken care of. Now, this is coming on the heels of just a month or so ago, just a number of weeks ago, where the NABU, which was their corruption, anti-corruption arm of the government, was at first, Zelensky says, you know what, we're just going to disband this. And he thought that he could just kind of get away with it. And he disbanded it, was moving on. They had a big firestorm and people said, oh, hell no, we're not going to allow that, et cetera. So the people rose up even during this wartime, and some of the other Western governments come in and they said, yeah, you ain't doing that. And so we put it back up there. Well, now it appears that, I guess, buoyed by this feeling like that with somebody's got their back, now then they're the ones that are uncovering some of this. And the question is going to be, will they find some more? What do you think?
Oh yeah, no, I mean, there's more out there. Like I said, this investigation by the Department of Defense is well advanced. I know that my buddy has been he's been in Germany, and in fact, he may be there today, meeting with other investigators. So, you know, this is what Zelensky's doing here is, I think, a little bit of diversion to try to pin it on somebody else and ignore his own responsibility. Of course, you know, every time I hear about Nabu, N-A-B-U, I keep thinking it's a new Japanese sushi restaurant, you know.
We should try that next time you're in town, by the way, if it is.
but you know, this party is coming to an end in Ukraine. The graft, the corruption, the ability to continue the war, this thing's now starting to wind down. And that's why I think one of the reasons you're starting to see stories like this, that you know, they'll find a convenient scapegoat. And I'm not suggesting that the guys that have been named are innocent and didn't engage in the conduct that's alleged. But I do know for a fact that Zelensky, if he's accusing them of taking $100 million, he's taken 10 times that. Okay. You know, he's taken much, much more than that. And, you know, they continue to plead for more money from the West, from Europe, from NATO, from the United States. And all it does is it's funding retirement programs.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, so in light of all this stuff that's going on there, by the way, and I'm gonna circle back in a minute to you know, what this specific corruption was involved with here. But just in the last about 24 hours, while he's mired in the middle of all this, Zelensky has not hesitated in reaching out and saying, hey, American senators, how's about you roll up some more money in this? U.S. senators, in the light of all of this stuff that's come to bear now, had this reaction in a weird kind of Zoom call.
What I'd like to know on the military front is, besides the Tomahawks, where can we be most helpful? Because I know continued military aid is very important, whether it's the Patriot missile interceptors or other weapon systems that would be helpful to you.
I wanted to first thank you for your leadership, thank the Ukrainian people for their courage. I don't have a question, but I wanted to let you know, I know the ambassador is following this very closely. In the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Risch, who couldn't join us today, is the chair. I'm the ranking member, but we have put forward the first three bills out of the committee to address, to go after Russia because of their actions.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And Gene, the same. Mr. President, you've got just amazing group of champions of Ukraine here on the Zoom. It's good to see you again.
The rest of the year and beginning of 26, we're going to go all in, giving you military capability to hurt the Putin war machine even more. And we're going to try to isolate Putin even stronger than we have today. If we can pass this bill making Russia a state sponsor of terrorism under U.S. law, that makes his economy radioactive.
Right.
Amen.
Amen, he says, makes it radioactive. All these people, thank you for your leadership, Mr. Zelensky. Even though the headlines are still wet on the paper about this $100 million, that, like you said, that's probably small potatoes compared to what the bigger one is, but that ain't small potatoes by itself. Thank you for your leadership here, and how can we give you more money? What do you make of that?
Well, I can simply tell you that one of the senators on that call, without pointing out specifically which senator it is, has received $16 million in kickbacks from Volodymyr Zelensky. Okay? One of those senators is
that's
up to
quiet.
His or her ass. I'll leave it without specifying the sex of the individual. You know, they're profiting off this war, tremendously so. So, you know, and this notion they're going to give, they're going to make Russia radioactive. Good luck with that. We're irrelevant. We've got no leverage over Russia. And, you know, the same time that, the you know, this, we see Scott Bessent, who's a creature of George Soros, by the way, the Secretary of Treasury, continues to indulge in this fantasy, this delusion that the U.S. sanctions are going to compel Russia to change what it's doing. Russia believes it's in an existential fight for its survival. And they will lose whatever they need to lose in order to win. They're going to make whatever sacrifice. And until these idiots in Washington, D.C. come to understand that, they're going to continue to pour money into a black hole that, and again, I come back to this headline that said it's money laundering. This is not money laundering. This is theft. Once you steal the funds and then you try to move it around to hide where it came from, that's money laundering. This is not money laundering. This is theft. This is graft. This is corruption. People don't understand the difference. Money laundering is when you take money that's been obtained from illegal activity and then you try to hide its origins. That's money laundering. This ain't it. This is theft.
Okay, well, that's a lot. Wait, that's not better. It's a grotesque malfeasance in any case, but I guess we do need to be accurate on what kind of, I mean, for the trial, maybe it would be helpful to get the right charges. I want to move on to another portion just because, again, from the source that I have here from Kiev is telling me that part of the corruption issue itself, and it goes way beyond just this Mendich fella, specifically has to do with the energy system. Now, obviously, Russia has been going on a several multiple year process to attrit, cause damage, and now in recent months just outright destroy the capacity for Ukraine to produce energy, heat, electricity, everything else for their war effort. Looks like that process has been damaged even further by their own malfeasance and looking for, in one report here, up to a 30% kickback for the Ukrainian officials to try to get some of this. And just like they did with their defensive capacity, like in 2023, 2024, et cetera, they didn't even do a lot of the work there. So the money just, you know, was distracted and it didn't work. So that's making the problem worse. Now, on top of all that, yesterday you had Secretary of State Rubio was talking about this and he just kind of seems to kind of shrug his shoulders like, I don't know, I guess it's a problem in their energy system.
Secretary, isn't your assessment that Russia does not really want peace?
Well, we can only go by what we see. I mean, I think they've stated clearly what they want is they want the rest of Donetsk. And obviously the Ukrainians aren't going to agree to that. So we've had those conversations with the Ukrainians about what they need, and I know that's ongoing. And, you know, clearly helping them survive the winter is important just from on a humanitarian ground. The challenge is that Ukraine's energy grid has been diminished each year. So each year they start at a lower baseline than the year before. Now I think in Kyiv, for example, upwards of 50 to 60% of the day is spent without electrical power. And they've done a tremendous job of sort of rerouting their grid and trying to work around it. But that also means there are hours of the day where you can't, there's no water, there's no electricity. You have to schedule business and life activities around that. And that's clearly part of Russia's strategy, is to try to collapse morale within the Ukraine and the will to fight. So, you know, that's why we've been in discussions with them about defensive weapons to be able to protect their grid. And I know we've been in ongoing technical conversations about the specific equipment they need. But ultimately, if that equipment is ultimately destroyed a week later after it's installed, that remains a problem. And that's been the history of the last.
Okay, so there's a number of real problems there that are not self-evident to some people. I'm going to bring that up in a second, especially about the defensive weapons. But let's look back at that grid issue, because he recognizes it's been going down each time. And then let me ask you first question. Do you think that he is unaware of the corruption being a problem to even undermining what they can do, even under the fire?
Oh, no. He knows. And, he, you know, the other aspect that's playing into this, apart from the corruption, is just there are a limited number, of transformers in the world. And the ones that Russia have been destroying are not easily replaced. So you've really got a perfect storm of, you've got incredible corruption. You've got the military destruction by Russia that's targeted at these power plants. And then you have a supply chain problem of being able to provide the replacement parts. And then one element of the corruption is these Ukrainian officials knowing that they need to buy these things, put themselves in the line of supply so that they get a kickback. You know, that's where part of these corruption allegations have come. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, I think one of the reasons that in previous years you didn't see Russia completely take out the electrical system like they are doing right now, is they did not have the manpower in terms of Russian troops in the field to be able to move forward and take advantage of the weakness on the part of Ukraine. They do now. They've got well over 700,000 soldiers deployed along the front lines, which is one of the reasons we're seeing this dramatic increase in the ops tempo by the Russians.
Well, now I want to examine here the strategic situation and intent of the United States specifically, because you have this announcement here, that this now public, and I can only imagine that they've known about this behind the scenes about the corruption for quite a long time. They've apparently been okay with it, but it's starting to have a physical impact on the strategic level of the war with this energy situation. But now, as you point out, the Russians are also ramping up their physical capability to take this stuff down. And then the last part of that comment by Rubio a while ago was just kind of, I was sloughed over, and no, I didn't see anyone ask any follow-up questions, but it was like a big red siren to me, where he said, well, what good does it do to give this defensive capabilities to the Ukraine when they're destroyed a week later? Which we have known, we've talked about that before, but it's not been admitted before. And if that's the case, if you know that the energy system has been coming down year after year, we don't have the defensive capability. We don't even have it to give to them. It's not going to make any difference. Then this war is going one direction and it's down the tubes for the Ukraine side. Why then do we want to ignore that and keep going as though what we observe with our own eyes is not happening?
Well, I think even the use of the term, quote, defensive weapon, what exactly is that? You know, if you have a weapon that's capable of inflicting death or serious bodily injury, okay? So it's a weapon. It's not defensive. If you're in a defensive situation where you're being attacked and you don't have the ability to press forward with an offense, yeah, you're using your weapons in a defensive capability. And so the use of the word strategic with respect to the United States, I don't think we can spell it. There's no strategy involved. Look at Scott Bessent. Bessent really believes that we've got economic leverage over Russia. And in fact, in that previous clip with all the senators, we're going to make Russia toxic. Nobody will come close to it. What these knuckleheads fail to understand is Russia has a self-sufficient economy. They don't need to export in order to have economic growth. They certainly don't need to import anything from anybody else in order to have economic growth. Yeah, they see the exports are one way that they can make themselves richer. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, almost 3 weeks ago now, when I sat with one of the senior economic ministers in Putin's government, and he made this point. He says, look, you folks in the West, you don't understand. Our economy is self. We can build a wall around ourselves and we'll be just fine. You're not. You need things from us. And he cited nitrogen for fertilizer, and he cited uranium, which is true. We're importing that from Russia still, despite all of our sanctions. We're going to put the screws to Putin. Now, the fact that we continue with this fantasy that we can use economic pressure to compel the Russians to change, it's just absolutely idiotic. It's stupid. It's not going to work. So we've got to step back and recognize, you know what? Russia is strong enough to survive quite well on its own without dealing with us. And in fact, we've just seen, remember, 3.5 years ago, we imposed the sanctions. You don't get to buy any more Boeing aircraft. And actually, I can hear some Russians going, thank God we're not going to be on those death traps.
Right. Yeah, the bolt on that one now. Anyway, yeah, don't want to. Yeah, that's a hell. Thank you.
Yeah, but what Russia has done is they have now just presented two new commercial airliners that are built entirely with all parts, all components from within Russia. Not a single thing from overseas. And we go, well, God, how could Russia do that? And it's like, we got so many Americans that forget that for like 20 years, it was the United States relying upon Russia to haul our sorry ass to the space station because we no longer had the capability
right.
to produce rockets that could get us there. We had to wait for Elon Musk to show up to us, and we get the claim, yeah, look at our American technology. Last I checked, he's South African, but, you know, minor point.
Yeah, and that just kind of leads you, we talk about the absence of a strategic view and just an unwillingness to acknowledge reality at the highest levels of our government. So that just kind of leaves us on, I won't even say a status quo, it's just drift. It's just, it's going wherever it goes. Well, I think that there are some in Western world, in NATO in particular, I think they do kind of have an idea. Now, it's a dark image, what I'm about to say here, and so I like your view on it because I don't have, you know, sources on the inside that can confirm this is the case. I'm just looking at what we can see from the outside, given the knowledge sure, sure. of the military balance between the two and how self-evident it is that Russia can only win. And yet with the statements coming out of NATO, it appears to me that they are focused on the cash flow that a conflict or even the potential conflict with Russia can generate, as Mark Rutte said here in Germany.
You are the German home of the first German-Netherlands Corps, an exemplary multinational effort and also part of NATO's high readiness forces. Every day the soldiers there are proving how we work together to make sure that our alliance remains safe. And you are home to many important defense companies. Strengthening our defense industry and increasing production are top priorities for NATO. At our historic summit in The Hague, allies agreed to spend 5% of GDP on defense. And now we need to make sure that we deliver.
Yeah, man, we got to make sure we deliver on that 5%. We just have to do this. Let's look at this from a military. Now, some people can look at that and they can say, well, obviously, if you're going to have a military, you have to have a defense industrial base. Otherwise, what are you going to fight with? You know, shovels and forks, you know, et cetera. So there's some validity to that. Yeah. But in light of the balance of power and the stated intent of the Russian side, the stated capacity that we can observe what they can and cannot do, where do you come down on how much of this is just hyping up a threat so that we get the defense industrial base to just keep rolling in the dough, and how much of it's legitimate?
No. Well, it's the former, not the latter. Look, what we've it took me a while. You know, it took me a couple of years to understand this, but I'm confident that I've got it correct. What we've seen with Russia, one of the criticisms that emerges out of the West is, oh, look how slow the Russians are moving. They've only been able to take this limited amount of territory, et cetera. And yet, when we look at the actual number of Russian forces, they've been building up slowly. They've not been in a panic. And what I mean by a panic, they haven't declared a national emergency at which they've mobilized, because they've got the potential to upward of 15 million men that they could mobilize immediately, reservists. They haven't done that. They've been doing, they had that one mobilization, then they've been relying upon both recruitment conscripts as well as contract soldiers. And when they bring them in, there's a gap, a 3 to 6 month gap between the time they show up, put on a uniform, and then that they're actually considered trained that they can move forward to the front lines. What we've seen in 2025 is finally Russia had reached a level of strength on the front lines that right now they are conducting 9 separate offensive operations all along that 1,300 kilometer line of contact. Significant. They've never done that before. They didn't do it in 2023, 2024. In each of those years, they were limited to 1, possibly 2 offensive operations. But now they've got the strength, the troop strength to do it. NATO still, after, you know, we're coming upon the fourth year of this, has still been unable to solve the problem of producing sufficient weapons and, you know, go down the category, drones, artillery shells, tanks, artillery barrels, air defense systems, Patriots. In no area does NATO have superiority or dominance over Russia? Not a single one. Now, they talk a good game. Yeah, we're going to do 5%. You know, reminds me of Wimpy from the Popeye commercial. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. We'll get that 5% to you. Just trust us. And we're supposed to trust them. Well, there's not a single economy in NATO, in the European version, that's growing above 1.5%. Not a single one. And several of them are actually in demonstrated recession. UK, Germany, France in particular are in recession. They're not growing. And the German factories are fleeing Germany because of rising energy costs that they self-inflicted. We'll destroy the Russian source. And then Western sanctions are leading countries like Bulgaria to say, and Hungary say, you're killing us here. You're going to make energy costs impossible. And so you're going to cripple our economies? So instead of seeing NATO come together, you know, Mark Rutte, we're all together. It's fragmenting and it's coming apart at the seams because there is no consensus. And Russia right now with the offense that's underway, I mean, it's now advancing. It did 42 square kilometers yesterday in Zaporizhia alone.
Oh, wow. In one day, I didn't see that.
So it's moving. It's doing it from the north. It's doing it from the south. And it's doing it from the east, moving west. And Ukraine doesn't have an answer because Ukraine doesn't have the manpower. They have been decimated over the course of the last 3.5 years. They're suffering basically 40,000 casualties per month. And they've been doing that every month of this year. Well, you know, here we are in month 11. So we're over 500,000. You know, so let's see, 440,000 casualties just this year alone, almost 500,000 men. They don't have the manpower. They don't have these large reserves, and they certainly don't have the luxury of being able to recruit people and put them through a training program that at the end of 6 months or 9 months, they come out somewhat competent and able to conduct combat operations. No, man, they throw a uniform on them, give them a gun, and say, get out there to the front. Good luck.
Yeah, well, that seems to corroborate your assessment there of the Ukrainian losses. And, of course, that doesn't even count any of the desertions that just add on to the loss of the manpower. Meanwhile, on the Russian side, they still have not had a need to go to a forced mobilization other than that first one of 300,000 several years ago. The motivations continue to be there for people to come in, the bonuses and all that stuff. A lot of them are high, fair enough, but it works and they get them in right there. The bottom line is they continue to calculate that it's worth it to come in, and take that risk for the benefit, because they think it's more benefit than there is loss. So that's just on the surface of it. But that seems to corroborate when you look at this in the bigger picture, especially when you're talking about the air war and the advancements in the Russian glide bombs, the advancements in their drone warfare, especially in the strategic versions, the Garand 3s, et cetera, their missile factory, all that stuff together. There are more and more people that are saying, I think that this could come to a culmination sometime, maybe even at the end of the winter, first of the spring. It's hard to see how they continue to make up. I mean, with those numbers, Larry, I mean, at some point, math has to affect, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, it was just yesterday, day before yesterday, the Russians unveiled a new military service. So they have set up a specific branch that deals exclusively with drone warfare. And the purpose of this is to integrate it fully into the other branches of service, so that it's fully integrated with both the operations of ground forces and the operations of the Air Force. But because it's sort of a unique level of skill that you've got they're using a combination of, they've now got AI-driven drones that do both reconnaissance and attack. So they are not dependent upon an operator. They no longer have an operator there giving them signals. They're able to operate independently. They've got that. They've got the the FPV drones, but that are driven with fiber optics, so they are immune to electronic warfare interference.
So yeah, I've also heard, Richard, I don't know if you've heard anything on this, that as a subset of that branch, they also have a department whose sole job it is to go find and then destroy the Ukrainian operators, not even the drones but the operators. Yeah. Can you tell us anything about that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's what that has been decided shift over the last 3 or 4 months, which is they recognize that these frontline troops that are sitting in trenches, they really don't represent much of a threat. You know, they're just there taking up space. They're going after the drones. I mean, the rapid development of the drone warfare on both sides. Russia, in 2023, you could make a case that Ukraine, with the assistance of NATO, had a decided advantage over Russia. But, the Russians were quick learners. And what they demonstrated was the troops in the field were communicating back up the chain of command. Chain of command was in communication with industry, and industry responded very rapidly. They were not constrained with the kinds of acquisition,
bureaucracy and whatever.
Yeah, boondoggles we get here in the West. So now Russia has not only caught up, they're now surpassed anything that that both Ukraine and or the West can do. So, they've now, like I said, there's not a single area of weapons development or technology in which the West has an advantage, not one.
And you say the West, not even just Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly. Not just Ukraine, NATO. I mean, NATO hasn't deployed a single operational hypersonic missile, for example. Russia's got at least 4 variants or 5, depending on how you count it. And so, we don't have that. And then when you've got this recent, with the Berezhnik, as well as the Poseidon missiles that were recently released. And again, I think your conversation with Ted Postol the other day was very insightful. It gives people a great understanding of, what some of those capabilities are. So the United States is lagging behind, and it's not like our economy is doing great. And so this we're good at talking, but we're not really good at doing.
Yeah, and that leads to, I think that we're nearing the point to where just the cumulative weight of all of these things is going to possibly sink the Ukraine side. And maybe by the springtime or the end of the winter, the Ukraine side just is not able to continue waging war anymore. What's that going to do to the West?
So let's look at what would we expect to see if Ukraine, let's say, had a viable chance of surviving. Okay. You'd see that their recruitment numbers were at around 50 to 60,000 a month. So they would both be able to replace the numbers that have been lost as casualties, as well as adding another 20,000 on top of that. Well, we're not seeing that. And if we were seeing that they were taking recruits and putting them through basic training or advanced individual training, I mean, you're from your days in service, that just because you put a uniform on somebody doesn't need that they know how to march or know the right from their left. So you got to start with those basics. And
let me just kind of add in a little interject here. Especially during my time when we fought in Desert Storm under Doug McGregor, I observed firsthand in the unit that I was in, how profoundly it matters how you're trained, even on top of who's in uniform. There was an organization, I was in a company size element. It was called Eagle Troop of 2nd Squadron, 2nd Cavalry. And we were not very good. When I first got there as a second lieutenant, the morale was really low. There was a very weak company commander that was in charge of it. And we did not perform well at all when we went to the National Training Center, the CMTC, they called it, the European version of the National Training Center, when we did these force-on-force things. We get one guy, and his name was H.R. McMaster at the company level.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some problems with how he was when he was National Security Advisor and what happened in Afghanistan. But as a company commander, he was spectacular under fire, and he just radically changed the tune. So when he came in at the same time, McGregor came in as the what they call the S3 operations officer, who was in charge of training the entire organization. It just turned it upside down, and we just became this lethal killing machine. But I saw other squadrons that did not get that kind of training and didn't have that kind of leadership in the same uniforms, in the same regiment, perform very, very different in combat. So what you're saying there is far more true, I think, than some people recognize, the training aspect.
Oh, yeah, no, it's critical. And, well, and implicit in that training, as you just, you didn't say it specifically, is leadership. If you got to have the right leadership. And unfortunately, what has happened in Ukraine is some of the best leaders have been killed or wounded and put out of action. And a large number of them have strong incentives to enrich themselves. They say, you know, there's no way we can win this, so I'm going to salt away some money for myself. And I mean, one of the ways they do it is they don't report casualties, because if they reported casualties, they'd have to do payouts. And so as they keep soldiers on the books, so the money keeps coming in for those soldiers, and they're able, for those soldiers who are dead or wounded, take the money and put it into their own bank account. I mean, that has been happening.
Do other soldiers in the unit, are they aware that this is going on, or is this kind of behind the scenes?
Absolutely.
And I mean, wouldn't do a lot for morale.
Yeah, morale. No, listen, morale is, it's terrible throughout the Ukrainian army. But there's still some who are, you know, they're fighting bravely. They believe in the cause for what it is. But, you know, until we start seeing those signs that they're able to recruit 60,000 a month, they're able to train them for a 3 to 6 month time period, and then they're able to be put into units that are properly led. But that's not happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, so we got to step back and say, okay, that's not happening. Whereas it is happening on the Russian side. I mean, one of the advantages, Russia's got the ability to reach in and touch any military base in Western Ukraine. Ukraine does not have the ability to target any military base whatsoever in Russia. And so Russia certainly can put its troops, you know, they're past the, you know, they're east of the Ural Mountains. They're quite safe there. They can conduct training without fear of being attacked. And it's just the reality. Then we in the West refuse to acknowledge or accept that. And then, but I think the more important aspect here is one of leadership. And there is, there's not a lot of confidence in the chain of command.
No, there's not. And that's pretty obvious when you look really from every level all the way on down. In the last segment, I want to talk about here something that could be even more important for the United States, and that's at the strategic level. And I'm specifically talking about the potential for nuclear escalation and conflict, which has always been kind of in the background, sometimes more so than others. Something that's always worried about, that I've always worried about, the longer the war goes on, the longer we keep alive the possibility of somebody making a dumb decision, an accident, a miscalculation, something, and things move in a bad direction. That has taken renewed focus here of late, because you mentioned a minute ago the Poseidon and the Burevestnik missile, both nuclear propulsion, one underwater, one up in the air, cruise missile, etc. So Vladimir Putin launched those and did a test, and it made a big kind of ballyhoo about, you know, we've now have this new capability as a deterrence against the West to say, don't mess with this because we have these new additional capabilities on top of what we already knew. So it didn't really change a whole lot, but just reinforced, no, really, we have a lot of capabilities. Don't test us here. Well, that wasn't the message that was received in the White House, apparently, because President Trump said, oh, yeah, you can test nuclear weapons. So can I. And he said, we're going to do nuclear tests. That's not what Russia did. And when tried to clarify that, what the United States meant, Trump never clarified it, because people say, wait, are you talking to, because he said a nuclear weapons test, not a platform test. And so they tried to get some clarification. He said, no, I'm going to do that. Well, the Russians apparently also asked for some clarification. They didn't get it either. However, on the 4th of November, at the U.S. Senate, there was a hearing for a fellow named Robert Kudlak, if I'm going to get that name correct here. Let me show you something that happened here in a hearing, because this was definitely noticed in Russia, and there was this very specific response from Sergei Lavrov. But let me show you. This is a conversation here and an answer or a question by Senator, former not naval. Well, I guess he was a naval aviator. He was also
astronaut. Right?
Astronaut. That's what the word I was trying to get in my head. Here's what, listen to this question that he asked and watch the answer about nuclear weapons testing.
If there is no benefit, or maybe if you think there is there anything to be said about destabilization?
And by the way, I'm sorry, he's being interviewed, or not interviewed here, but his hearing is to be the Assistant Secretary of Defense for nuclear deterrence and weapons testing. So that is his role.
By doing this.
Senator, I appreciate the question. And I would just offer that at this stage in an earlier questioning, there was a question about what was meant by the opportunity or issue of testing at this moment. I would just highlight more from a background or context perspective. There seems to be three reasons why you would want to test. One are technical uncertainties about the weapon. And clearly, I think in the context of what has happened recently with the president receiving the report that certifies our stockpile is both safe, secure, and effective and reliable, that doesn't seem to be the issue. The second one seems to be broadly whether or not there is an issue around the qualifications or capabilities of the nuclear enterprise in terms of how that would be affected by resuming testing. And clearly, we're making huge investments to recapitalize and modernize our enterprise, both the human capital as well as the physical capital. So that doesn't seem to be the issue. The third one seems to be whether there's geopolitical context or reasons to do that. Earlier, I mentioned, not based on the president's comments, but based on a review of compliance reports by State Department going back to 2019, that would suggest that there's been a concern about both Russia and China's adherence or compliance with the threshold test ban treaty and whether or not there's been any issues around that. Obviously, that's a classified set of issues. It was identified such in the State Department, in the State Department reports, and that's something that I have not been briefed on.
Okay, so bottom line is here. He says there are several reasons why you might want to do a test. One is the reliability of the weapon system. He said that's not an issue. We definitely are reliable there. Another one might be, is there any other operational constraints? He said there's not really there either. But the issue of the strategic environment, maybe there could be something there, but that's beyond my pay grade. I'm not going to worry about that. That was heard in Moscow. Here is how Sergey Lavrov responded to that, I think yesterday.
Kadlec, who is running for the position of Assistant Secretary of Defense, stated that it is necessary to develop nuclear response options for certain potential regional conflicts. This is also an interesting statement. It is already a direct indication that this gentleman, in his future position as Assistant Secretary of Defense, will be thinking in the spirit of threats to use nuclear weapons in order to achieve solutions desired by the United States in one region or another.
And Gary, I'm sorry, I should have played the other one first. If you can play the other one by Sergey Lavrov on that same topic, that would be even better.
Mr. Robert Kadlec has been nominated for the position of Assistant Secretary of Defense, as the head of the Pentagon is now called. He spoke in Congress a few days ago, last week, I believe. He was interrogated on the topic of nuclear testing and the current administration's approach to nuclear weapons. He said that Trump's decisions to resume nuclear testing were dictated by geopolitical considerations. There is still no technical necessity for them. This is a strong statement. I do not know to what extent the author himself, whom I have just quoted, realizes the seriousness of what he said. But we must perceive this in the sense that, as we have stated, there is no technical necessity for such tests. Then he himself, in a way, completed this thought for us by saying that the purpose, it turns out, is geopolitical. What could be a geopolitical goal for the United States? Dominance. If the factor of nuclear weapons is being used for this purpose, that is alarming.
So as a real background, President Putin himself just a week or so ago said that we will continue to abide by the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the NPT treaty, unless the United States tests first, and then we're going to test as well. But now here you have this Assistant Secretary of Defense nominee suggesting that maybe we will. What do you make of it?
Well, again, you got to look at it as the Russians perceive it. number one, George W. Bush canceled the anti-ballistic missile treaty agreement, walked away from arms control. The U.S. administrations, both Republican and Democrat, now under Trump, have always used the excuse that, oh, China and Russia are violating the terms of the agreement. Oh, they're breaking with what they signed on to. With really no evidence of that. But then, again, who was it that suspended the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement? That was Donald Trump. And most the latest is the request by Russia to the United States, are we going to continue to abide by the New START Treaty? And again, silence, crickets coming out of Washington, D.C., no agreement. So, you know, obviously both the Russians and the Chinese have to, based upon these statements, have to assume the United States is preparing for nuclear war. And therefore, they have no other alternative but to make similar preparations. That is the last thing in the world they want to do. But we're in, you know, for those in your audience who are under the age of 50, encourage them to go look up the movie Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick's movie. You need to watch that because we're back into that kind of era. And it's, you know, it's the United States is hurtling towards some very dangerous territory.
There's a new one now, the House of Dynamite on Netflix right now. That's just as alarming. For those who may not know, Dr. Strangelove is kind of a comedic look of it, an old black and white film. Yeah, it is. It's funny to watch, but it's also scary. The House of Dynamite is just scary because it puts it in a modern context. But in every capacity, it is alarming what's going on. And let me just ask you: Do you think that Trump just when he heard about the Burevestnik test or the Poseidon test, that he just said, "Oh yeah, well we're going to do that too," and just didn't understand terminology kind of matters in this case. We'll say we'll do a nuclear test, and that's actually what he meant. And there was a Minuteman test happened not long after that. Or do you think he actually means he would conduct a nuclear weapons test? What do you think?
No, I don't think he knows. He was just reacting emotionally, but as he is wont to do. It really reminded me. So back in 1981, so this was still during the height of the Cold War, I was teaching at American University in the Washington Semester Program, and part of my I had 3 days a week I'd have to fill with speakers. So I took my students down to the then Soviet embassy. And at this time, one of the issues that was, you know, sort of a hot button issue between the Soviets and the United States was the deployment of the Pershing II missiles into Europe. This intermediate range ballistic missile that was seen there as to counter what the Soviets were doing. It wasn't clear the Soviets had the same capability at that time. And when we got in and started talking to, you know, I assume it was a political counselor, the Soviets then were very defensive and quite insecure. And so when we brought up the fact, well, you know, the United States has the Pershing II missile, the reaction was like, well, we got that too. Yeah, we got that too. And that's the first, when Trump started speaking, man, that was the first thing I thought about. Because he's speaking from a position of weakness, not of strength. Because as you know, when you've got the strength on your side, when you've got, you know, you're solid about what you're doing, you don't need to talk. You just sort of nod your head and say, oh, that's interesting. Because you know what you can do. And you know that you've got the other side beat. The Russians are being very clear right now that they are extremely concerned with the comments. It's not just what Trump is saying. It's comments coming out from other officials in the Trump administration. And they can only assume that the United States is intent upon using nuclear weapons. And therefore, they have to take appropriate measures to defend themselves.
And according to what Sergey Lavrov has said, and the defense minister, Belousov, I believe his name is, opened a test, or they're in the process of actually taking out of mothballs an actual nuclear testing facility. So in the event that an order is given, they're going to make effective it. I don't think that they're bluffing. I think that they're probably telling the truth. The question is, do you think that that message, because I can imagine, you tell me if I'm interpreting wrong, I think the only reason they would do that to actually make good on that, to bring the thing out of mothballs, is as a deterrent to tell us don't do it, especially in combination with Putin's claim that we won't do it unless you do, and then I think we will. Will the message be received?
Well, yeah, and it's I would say no, it won't be received because when the
I was
when
hoping
the
Russians, you were saying something different.
When the Russians do that, then we'll use that as justification. See, they're intent on attacking us, so we got to do. So we use it as an end up talking past each other, and it's that famous line from one of the Paul Newman movies. What we have here is a failure to communicate, and the communication is key. But as you know, we saw the other day that Scott Bessent, the Secretary of Treasury, called Kirill Dmitriev, who is Putin's basic envoy for talking to the United States about opening up lines of communication, Bessent called him a liar. Called him a liar because simply Dmitriev disagrees with Bessent's belief. Bessent believes that through economic pressure, we can weaken Russia. And Dmitriev has been, no, you can't. It's you think those sanctions are going to have the effect, they're not. And instead of, dealing with that as a disagreement between people where you can at least have some mutual respect, Bessent devolved into this insult. And it's just, okay, that doesn't help. That doesn't help the communication. We're getting pushed towards a nuclear threshold that is very, very dangerous.
Yeah, and that's like I keep saying every time, and we'll continue to, that's not bad for the United States. It's not bad for Russia. It's bad for the planet. And nobody would win in such a situation, and I pray to God that we don't lose our minds and go down a path that can't succeed, and it can only destroy our own way of life is what it is. And we'll have to wait and see, but there it is. That's where we have it.
Well, it's important what you're doing, when you bring on people like Ted Postol and people like Doug McGregor and myself, where we get a chance to try to say, hey, look, there is an alternative here. And it's a pathway built around dialogue and talking to one another. We don't need to fight and kill ourselves.
No, we certainly don't need to do that. And, one of the reasons we love having you on, besides the fact that you always have great wardrobe choices. But other than that, you also have some great things to say. We really appreciate that. Be sure and go to sonar21.com where you don't have to wait for Larry to be on here once a week. We'd love to have it more, but you don't have to wait. You can go and see his work there. He's always got some interesting things. We always are watching it and reading some of those things. So be sure and check him out there, and we will look forward to seeing you next time that you're on the show.
Thanks so much, Danny. It's always a pleasure.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Also, we got another show for you coming up at, I believe it's 3 o'clock. No, 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. We have Matthew Ho, former State Department official. Great, great American. Somebody we love to have on the show. And you're going to not want to miss what he has to say this afternoon at 2 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. And also, be sure and let your friends know who may like to get their information via podcast that we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Be sure and type... And you will find us there ahead of our jingle, which Gary will now play.